The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The November midterms are bearing down like the horses on the backstretch at the Kentucky Derby, and the Missouri Senate race could be a bellwether on how damaging it may be to Democrats. James O'Keefe looks at the incumbent, Democrat Claire McCaskill.
What this investigation exposes is that in order to get elected, you have to lie to the people. And that's what all of the staffers are saying.
Hurricane Michael did a number on some of our finest military assets.
17 F-22s are damaged. I think 10 of those were kept in the storm-rated hangar. But no hangar is built to withstand 150-plus mile-per-hour winds.
President Trump got hammered on something he didn't say. And one of Trump's bashers may have a red face.
How do you screw that up? You screw that up because you have a predisposition to find the worst possible thing the president says and interpret what he says to the extent that you can as a racist comment.
And is the Saudi crown prince going to survive what looks like a self-inflicted crisis?
I expected we would hear that this rogue operative was associated with some old regime who was trying to be a James Bond, and it went horribly wrong.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. East Coast, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. The November midterms are scarcely more than 2 weeks away. Mail-in ballots are already flowing in. Early voting underway. Congress is in the crosshairs of the electorate. Will Democrats get power back in the House? And what about the Senate? Could the GOP actually gain seats? 2, 3, maybe even 4. Several current Democratic seats are in the spotlight. Those in North Dakota, Indiana, Florida, but none more than Missouri, as incumbent Democrat Claire McCaskill wants to hang on to her seat against her very able challenger, Missouri's Attorney General Josh Hawley. My colleague Larry Elder spoke with James O'Keefe of Project Veritas. This time, O'Keefe's investigative team dove deep inside the McCaskill campaign.
We've got some news because Claire McCaskill just responded to our hidden camera investigation. She attacked the video, of course, but she made a false statement in this statement she put out. She said that the Republican candidate for Senator Josh Hawley had fraudulently embedded somebody in her campaign. That is not correct. This had nothing to do with Josh Hawley. I've never spoken to him. I was the main investigator involved in this investigation. And just so your listeners know, our investigation of Claire McCaskill's campaign showed multiple staffers saying that her and McCaskill and Obama's policies are the same, but, quote, people just can't know that. Other staffers talk about banning semi-automatic rifles, and McCaskill herself was caught on hidden camera in the office talking to someone she thought worked for her, saying that there would be a gun ban of some type. So McCaskill's now just responded on local news in Missouri, claiming that the Republican Senate candidate had something to do with this, which he did not. But she's definitely on defense if you look at this response that she just put out.
James O'Keefe, I looked at the video. Not only does the staffer talk about banning semi-automatic rifles, he talks about banning semi-automatic firearms.
That's right. They talk about handguns. Claire herself talks about when she gets into the Senate, she'll vote with the so-called Chuck Schumer wing of the party. Obviously, the red state Democrats have to walk a fine line because most of the people there are moderate. They're not leftist. They're moderate to pro-life, to pro-gun Democrats. It's still a thing in Missouri. It's still a thing in these swing states. So what this investigation exposes is that in order to get elected, you have to lie to the people. And that's what all of the staffers are saying. Mm-hmm. He's saying the moderates will just have to get over being lied to. It's very devastating, very powerful. I mean, maybe the most powerful undercover investigation we have ever done because it involves a sitting U.S. senator has now responded to all of her staffers calling her a liar.
Here is Claire McCaskill's response, James O'Keefe.
Well, it is startling that Josh Hawley would be part of fraudulently embedding somebody in my campaign. He's the attorney general of the state of Missouri. He's supposed to be going after fraud, not participating in it. So there was nothing there. I've been very upfront about all my positions. I've made no secret that I think we can support the Second Amendment. What's really telling about this is how far they're willing to go to fraudulently embed somebody in my campaign.
Well, first of all, it's a bold-faced lie. It's categorically and unequivocally false that Josh Hawley had anything to do with our investigative journalism. I've never met him. And she just lied on local TV in Missouri, Larry, that what's going to happen next is this other Senate candidate, Josh Hawley, is going to say that he had nothing to do with it. She's going to have to respond to that. Mm-hmm. So I think we're achieving our goal of holding these people accountable, and I think that she's in a lose-lose situation.
The hurricane that ravaged the Florida panhandle northward from the Gulf was horribly unpredictable. The death toll is now past 30. Tyndall Air Force Base near Panama City took a serious hit, and it's one of the sites of our elite F-22 fighter jet fleets. Anyone concerned with our nation's fighting ability ought to be concerned about that. I turn to a regular on my program, Congressman Mike Gallagher of the House Armed Services Committee. He's a defense expert and a Marine Corps intelligence veteran himself. Let's get right down to it. The danger zone has receded. According to, I'm reading a Real Clear Politics story here, the Congressional Leadership Fund has seen six districts, Will Hurd, Andy Barr, Mike Bost, Rodney Davis, Brian Mass, John Katko, recede into safe, comfortable territory. If we're down to 20 to 30 districts that are competitive, and they sound pretty optimistic about holding the House, Mike Gallagher, what do you think?
Well, this is anecdotal, but certainly in the Republican Party offices we have around my district in Northeast Wisconsin, we've seen an upsurge in volunteers coming in, people coming in that aren't necessarily party faithful to pick up signs and ask, what can I do to help? So I do sense a slight momentum shift. I've always thought this was going to be a knife's edge when we talk about control of the House, you know, five seats one way or the other. But also my understanding is that we have real opportunities to pick up some seats from Democrats in Minnesota, and that the Democrats are pulling out of a couple seats that look to be trending in our direction. So, again, we got to run through the tape. This is, you know, we're fighting against the forces of history here. Can't take anything for granted. And ultimately, it's just going to come down to candidate quality in sort of this 20 to 30 seats that we're talking about here.
All right, now let me talk to you about some defense issues. First of all, the F-22s at Tyndall. It's a murky picture. I read this very close, and it seems like people are trying to say, yeah, we got hurt, but we didn't get hurt that bad, but maybe we did get hurt that bad. Maybe dings to stealth technology are very hard to repair. What's your assessment, and why, by the way, do we keep F-22s at a hurricane area?
So as best I can tell from trying to read through this, and I'm looking forward to being back in session in November so we can ask some hard questions of the DOD to figure out what exactly happened. It seems like 17 F-22s are damaged. I think 10 of those were kept in the storm-rated hangar, but no hangar is built to withstand 150-plus mile-per-hour winds, and seven of the 17 were in lesser-rated hangars. I think it's important to note that no one thought this would be a 4- to 5-level hurricane 48 hours prior. I'm not trying to make excuses for the military here. But the planes are based at Tyndall so that they can have access to the training range over the Gulf of Mexico. No one would want a bunch of F-22s going into Super Cruise over Kansas. It's too disturbing to the local communities. We also wouldn't want people to be able to film and monitor their operations over safer areas of the country. So as best I can tell, in talking to officials, talking to experts on the outside, it looks like most of them will be repaired. But the problem here is the skin on the plane. There's a lot of radar absorbent material, RAM, involved, and the repairing and replacing could be very expensive. And my understanding is that the initial site survey suggests that the airframes appear to be okay. So we believe we can get most of them back on track, but repairing the skins will be a very expensive proposition. Finally, Hugh, I just say, kind of your question, you know, why were so many there grounded? This goes back, really, to the Obama administration decision to halt the program in 2009. Secretary Gates was the ultimate decider of that decision, and the decision to cut back on Air Force personnel and train maintainers and funds for readiness. So if we had to answer the question that so many were on the ground in the first place with their engines pulled, it's because of a lack of spare parts and a lack of trained people to repair them.
Our president is doing worthy job campaigning with candidates in vulnerable, critical House and Senate races. In Ohio, he took time to praise the work of some of America's political and military heroes who hailed from the state. His salute to Civil War General Ulysses Grant was preceded by the mention of Grant's number one opponent, General Robert E. Lee. Larry Elder shows how media misused a soundbite to paint Trump as a racist.
Trump is being criticized for praising General Robert Lee.
Ohio is the state that gave us a great president who hasn't been properly recognized, okay? William McKinley has not been properly recognized. It also gave you a general who was incredible. He drank a little bit too much. You know who I'm talking about, right? So Robert E. Lee was a great general.
Can you hear that? He says, so Robert E. Lee was a great general.
Who I'm talking about, right? So Robert E. Lee was a great general.
Okay, got that.
And Abraham Lincoln developed a phobia. He couldn't beat Robert E. Lee. He was going crazy. I don't know if you know this story. But Robert E. Lee was winning battle after battle after battle. And Abraham Lincoln came home. He said, I can't beat Robert E. Lee. And one day, it was looking really bad. And Lincoln just said, you hardly knew his name. And they said, don't take him. He's got a drinking problem. And Lincoln said, I don't care what problem he has. You guys aren't winning. And his name was Grant, General Grant. And he went in and he knocked the hell out of everyone. He started to win. Grant really did. He had a serious problem, a serious drinking problem. But man, was he a good general. And he's finally being recognized as a great general. But Lincoln had almost developed a phobia because he was having a hard time with a true great fighter and a great general, Robert E. Lee. But Grant figured it out. And Grant is a great general. And Grant came from right here.
So NBC puts out the story. Watch. President Trump says Robert E. Lee was a great general during Ohio rally, calling the Confederate leader incredible. Then they issued a correction. An earlier tweet misidentified the general President Trump described as incredible at a rally in Ohio. It was General Ulysses S. Grant, not General Robert E. Lee. An attached video clip lacked the full context for Trump's remark. Here is the full clip. How do you screw that up? You screw that up because you have a predisposition to find the worst possible thing the president says and interpret what he says to the extent that you can as a racist comment.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
The mood music for a while has indicated that Saudi Arabia would pin the blame on some scapegoat. And that seems like the way things are headed at this hour.
Saudi Arabia's crown prince is under the spotlight when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist until 2 weeks ago. That's when he disappeared into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and was murdered. If we are to believe reports, it was a brutal murder. The Turkish government first pointed an accusatory finger at Saudi rulers. An alternative explanation is rogue operatives took it upon themselves to carry out the murder of Khashoggi. By midweek, the world still lacked a plausible answer. I turned to Middle East expert David Kirkpatrick of the New York Times and a personal acquaintance of Khashoggi. What was your relationship with Jamal Khashoggi?
Well, he was a source. You know, he was somebody I was friendly with in the sense that we would have lunch together and chit-chat. You know, not someone I would have over to my house for dinner or something like that. But, you know, I knew him. We all knew him. He was a hard guy not to like.
What do you see happening, David?
Well, the mood music for a while has indicated that Saudi Arabia would pin the blame on some scapegoat in their security services, that Turkey was likely to accept that explanation as long as Saudi Arabia acknowledged that Jamal Khashoggi had been killed inside the consulate in Istanbul. And that seems like the way things are headed at this hour. A well-informed source who knows what the court's up to told me that Saudi Arabia had identified the person they are going to say is responsible. He put it more earnestly and said the person that is responsible, someone in the intelligence services who knows Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman personally and felt like he this person in intelligence, had the authorization to carry out some kind of a rendition, and that went horribly wrong. If you've been following Saudi Arabia or you've been following this story, that doesn't seem terrifically plausible, but it's convenient for Saudi Arabia, for Turkey, and for the United States to find a way to move on.
This is the Henry II defense from when the English king said, "No, will no one rid me of this troublesome priest and four of his knights go off and slaughter Thomas of Becket in Canterbury Cathedral?" It works in, you know, the 12th century. I'm not sure it works today, David, absent a public judicial proceeding that the West can pursue. What do you think?
Well, what does works mean? You know, for governments, I mean, governments make do with partial truths fairly often. The court of public opinion is a different matter. I think at this point, after all that we've seen leaked by Turkish officials and all that's been confirmed, it's going to be hard for Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to repair his reputation. You know, he'd gotten pretty far in the West as a reformer and somebody who was going to open up the kingdom, kind of an innovator and a new kind of leader for Saudi Arabia. I think he's going to have a lot of trouble now getting the kind of selfies with Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg that he's been accustomed to.
If, in fact, the person that has been identified to you by a good source as likely to be pointed to as the prime mover of the rendition gone bad implicates MBS in ordering the rendition, does that do you think the royal court changes in succession?
There's two elements there. First of all, I think this person, this intelligence official who's going to take the blame, if that person is tried, that person will be tried in a Saudi court. So that's not the kind of court we're used to where the defendant might have an opportunity to blame the crown prince. You know, in the past, a crown prince who came under this kind of a cloud might have trouble with the succession.
In speaking with Kirkpatrick, I mentioned his recent book, Into the Hands of Soldiers, and that he had been a Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. As such, he is well qualified to unravel the often mysterious geopolitics of the region. Our conversation continues.
Saudi Arabia has changed. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has consolidated power like no figure in the kingdom in decades. He holds all the key levers. And so the best handicapping is that there's no one in a position to challenge him. While there are many people in the kingdom who are enjoying criticizing him over this, he's made many enemies along the way. None of them seems to have enough heft to push him out of the line of succession as long as his dad is okay with it. And his dad is elderly and may not be that competent right now.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wrapped up a very brief meeting with the king not too long ago. Is he expected to meet with MBS when he's there?
I'm expecting that he will. I don't know the details of his schedule.
All right. So is it possible that there is within the government, this is just a range of possibility. I'm giving you the second option, which is you accept responsibility, but not guilt. The other one is you say someone was trying to take me out. The rogue operative was actually working to advance the exiled faction of the royals that I had imprisoned at the Ritz-Carlton. Has that been floated anywhere yet?
No. You know, and to be honest, cynical as I am, I expected that's what they would go with. I expected we would hear that this rogue operative was associated with some old regime. But in fact, what I'm told we're going to hear is that the rogue operative is someone who actually was a friend of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who felt like he had the okay from the Crown Prince to do this rendition, and who was trying to make a name for himself, who was trying to impress everybody with his daring do and be a quote-unquote James Bond. And it went horribly wrong.
Will that be enough for the United States? John Bolton and I talked about this at that point. He said, we don't have the facts. It's the Middle East. Anything is possible. That was last Thursday. Would the Henry II defense be sufficient for the United States?
Well, a key question here is, has Turkey shared its intelligence? Turkish officials have leaked to many people, including me, that they are in possession of audio and maybe video from inside the consulate showing who did what in the assassination. You know, they've got the goods. If they've shared that with their U.S. intelligence counterparts, who often work very closely with the Turks, then that's one thing. And if they haven't, if they've only briefed about it, that's another. That diminishes the degree of seriousness for the U.S. and diminishes the pressure on the U.S. to try to pursue this. It depends on what the Turks have shared, really.
All right. Now, does it impact, for example, the war in Yemen? This is actually where it comes home. This is the anti-Iran alliance being stressed. This is Jordan and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Israel and America trying to confront the Houthis who are sending rockets into Saudi Arabia that are made in Iran. Does this break that anti-Iranian alliance, which many of us have welcomed as being a necessary course correction in the Middle East?
I'm not sure this has any impact on the Iranian alliance. I don't see the United Arab Emirates or Israel or Egypt showing any squeamishness whatsoever about what's been done here. And so far, it looks like President Trump is very willing to accept this explanation. He was even yesterday, you know, getting ahead of the Saudis and already suggesting that this was a rogue operator before the Saudis had begun to float that explanation themselves. So I think the geopolitics are likely to remain unchanged so long as the succession inside Saudi Arabia is unchanged.
And therefore, arms sales uninterrupted. The American public accepts it and moves on because it is an exotic story. It reads like a thriller. Jamal Khashoggi has a lot of friends, but it is very difficult to keep a story like this above the fold for very long, David Kirkpatrick.
Yeah, I think where, as I tried to say before, where it's going to hit the crown prince is with elite opinion. You know, in Wall Street and Silicon Valley. He's enjoyed the company of those people. He's worked hard to get them to invest in Saudi Arabia, to bring their businesses and their insights and their know-how to help diversify the Saudi economy. He's going to find it very hard to be a front man for that sort of effort. And that's not trivial, because Saudi Arabia, over the not too long term, has got some real issues in terms of being able to support their economy on their oil revenue.
Listen to the entire interview with New York Times reporter David Kirkpatrick on townhallreview.com. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Last Monday, I got a call from the Vice Chancellor. He said to me, to be honest, I don't understand their grievance against you, and I have to be sensitive to that.
The disinvitation of a counter-terrorist by her alma mater. When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Disinvitations by universities have become commonplace in our present injury-avoiding campus culture. We've seen this in the shocking reality at UC Berkeley, Claremont College, especially Middlebury College, where Charles Murray was roughed up. When a campus conservative invites a speaker in, well, look out. In the most recent example, it was the university that invited the speaker. Lisa Daftari is a graduate of Rutgers who's now a counterterrorism expert. She was invited to speak by her alma mater. But a day before she was to speak, they abruptly disinvited her. My colleague Dennis Prager spoke with Lisa on his show.
So you were about to speak at your alma mater, Rutgers University. What was the topic supposed to be?
Well, the school recommended over a year ago, the school recommended radicalism on college campuses before this fiasco even started with a petition and a cancellation and all of that. I basically brought in the speech to be about freedom of speech on campus, listening to others, how far is too far, not going out with empty hashtags and signs and T-shirts, but actually building that dialogue on campus. If I had to say it quickly or short, I would say it was about the freedom of speech, ironically.
What was the date of your scheduled speech?
Last Monday, I got a call from the Vice Chancellor alerting me to the fact that there is a petition and some concern by some students. One student started this, ironically. The student is the head of the College Progressive. He worked on Bernie Sanders' campaign, and he is also on the Muslim Public Relations Committee, the Muslim Student Organization, on campus. The Vice Chancellor told me that he met with these students, and only a handful showed up. He said to me, To be honest, I don't understand their grievance against you, but they feel injured, and I have to be sensitive to that. Now,
I need to assimilate that. A few students felt injured, and he canceled your speech?
Based on baseless allegations, Dennis, the falsification of quotes. I mean, I was so blown away by this because, as you know me well, I am of Iranian descent and have always taken such a nuanced position with regards to differentiating between Muslim people and the use or the hijacking, if you will, of Islam in political Islam and extremism. And I've always taken the position that Muslims died on 9/11 just like Jews and Christians did, and that it is the duty of the Muslim leadership in this country to help name and shame.
Okay, it won't. Okay, you know, though, that according to progressive thought, what you just said is Islamophobic. Singling out Muslim leaders to condemn Muslim extremism is, in their perverse world, bigotry.
And, you know, the conversation is just so devoid of fact. You know, that's what was painful about this. And I will add, Dennis, we've seen a lot of campus shutdowns by a lot of, you know, wonderful speakers that you and I know. But it's usually based on some, you know, interest group, whether it's the campus Republicans or a pro-Israel group or the Hillel or the Chabad on campus. I was invited by the university itself, Rutgers University Undergraduate Academic Office. And to be invited and then disinvited based on falsification of quotes, they quoted me in the petition, leaving out the most operative word of in a talk I gave at Heritage Foundation, where I said, Islamic terror claims to take its inspiration from the Quran. And two of my followers very kindly went and dug up this video from 2015, which I didn't even know existed because, frankly, I knew that this allegation was baseless, but they actually found the video in which I said Islamic terror claims to take its inspiration from the Quran. I mean, it's just lack of integrity.
Wait, and they dropped the word claims?
Absolutely. Deliberately dropped the word claims.
Right. Yeah, that's regular. Yes.
That's right, very regular. And then they, you know, this was all in the Q&A portion of my talk at Heritage Foundation in 2015. And then they go on to say, if you're a Muslim woman and you want to be part of your religion, you're going to join ISIS and become a jihadi wife. But it was a partial answer to a question someone in the audience asked about how do they recruit women. And I said, well, when they have a husband who's already part of the cause, they are led to believe that they also can be part of the cause. Again, here we are, 2018, progressive students defending ISIS and the campus adhering to these false allegations against someone. I mean, all it would take is a very shallow Google search to see that I've been invited to speak at the United Nations, invited to give briefings under President Obama in Washington, and as you said, invited onto CNN as often as I am invited onto Fox News. But it was a very cowardly move by the university. They tried to keep it going, but they canceled.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
It's basically inbred into the American psyche. I learned more about American history going from colonial America and Plymouth all the way to the current days.
Alan Greenspan, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Alan Greenspan was the chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve Board from 1987 all the way to 2006. Chairman Greenspan helped steer this country through at least two recessions, during which he avoided frightening inflationary spirals that often come and go with great devastation. The chairman, at age 92, has co-authored a great book with Adrian Woolridge, Capitalism in America, a History. He was a recent guest of mine on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Capitalism in America History is the brand new book authored by Alan Greenspan and Adrian Wooldridge. Of course, you know Alan Greenspan as the legendary chairman of the Federal Reserve from 1987 to 2006. What you may not know is he's a brilliant writer, and this sweeping history of capitalism in America is really a book I have been waiting for decades. Mr. Greenspan, I am curious as to why, after such a storied and distinguished career, you would undertake, this had to be a lot of work. Capitalism in America is large and long and great, but it had to have been a lot of work.
It was a lot of work, but you have to understand that for economists like myself, it's a learning experience, and I'm always trying to get new ideas as to how the domestic and global economies work.
Well, I've got to tell you, Mr. Chairman, I've been teaching law students for 23 years, and I've always longed for a book that could explain to the underlying economic dynamism that has birthed the constitutional order and regulatory system we have. I finally got it, and I thank you for that. They're going to have to read this now in every class, and they're going to love reading it because they'll finally have a grasp of how we got here. I always begin, how did we get here? And we got here because of capitalism. Is that a fair statement?
That is an exactly correct statement.
Okay, so I'm going to cover with you a number of subjects because the book begins at the beginning and ends at the present day. But I want to start at the end because it's kind of dark. America's fading dynamism. And I quote from page 396, Winston Churchill once said to his fellow countrymen that we have not journeyed across the centuries, across the oceans, across the mountains, across the prairies, because we are made of sugar candy. But Alan Greenspan writes, today, thanks to a malign combination of litigation, regulation, pedagogical fashion, sugar candy people are everywhere. Can you expand on that, Mr. Chairman?
It's basically inbred into the American psyche. In fact, that's what defines us. It's the entrepreneurial spirit, which doesn't exist in its form any other place in the world. And when you go back and you look at history, it is just awesome. I mean, I learned more about American history writing this book with Adrian Wooldridge, incidentally, who I don't want to leave out of the loop because he's a critical factor here. And the two of us worked pretty much picking up the periods going from colonial America and Plymouth all the way through to current days.
But at the end, your tone is not optimistic, Mr. Chairman.
Well, it's not optimistic because it's a single statistic, which I find terribly worrisome. And that, hoping not to get too complex, the data on gross domestic savings and government social benefits or entitlements is remarkably stable, implying that one is driving out the other.
Oh.
And it's not credible that the economy as a whole is being affected, but it's perfectly credible if you think in terms of what basically entitlements are. They're actions implemented under government edict and have, therefore, of necessity, if you're trying to figure out who is doing what to whom, and you find out that the sum of two as a percent of GDP is remarkably flat since 1965, then you conclude of necessity that it is entitlements which are driving out the savings. And then I go further into the analysis and demonstrate that as savings fall, we borrow from abroad, and where now I might add, have an $18 trillion debt to foreigners. And the combination of that is you basically are crowding out productive capital investment.
That does come through. But I was curious about the current situation. There was an argument that Donald Trump's election unleashed the animal spirits again. Now, you're a student of irrational exuberance, a student of bubbles. Does the current period of vigor in the economy look like a bubble to Alan Greenspan?
Well, it would if it were done in a different manner. That is, I find that the particular tax cut is one which does unleash capital investment and hence productivity and hence standards of living. The only problem is we're not paying for it.
Yes.
And as a result, what you're seeing now is a dramatic rise in federal debt to the public. And nobody cares about federal debt to the public. It's not a political issue. until it ultimately engenders inflation.
I have to ask you about one headline. Fidelity says it will trade Bitcoin for hedge funds. All right, Alan Greenspan, what do you make of cryptocurrencies in our current market situation?
Well, you have to understand what is a cryptocurrency. It's the first cryptocurrency I know which relates to the world at large was the Continentals, which were issued in 1775 to fund the war. It's paper money, and paper money has no backing to it. And as a result, what happened in 1775 when the whole structure of finance fell apart is that fiat currencies don't exist indefinitely unless they're backed in some prudent fiscal way. Bitcoin is a fiat currency. When you have a fiat currency, it's either a plus addition to finance or zero. You can never have a negative value for a fiat currency. And so the result is if it's never going to be negative, to the extent that it is positive, since coming down from the par value to originally, as in the Continentals, to zero, there is purchasing power implicit in that, and General Washington was able to procure a goodly part of the substance needed to finance the Revolutionary War with a depreciating currency. But until it depreciates to zero, it still has purchasing power. And if you add them all up over the years when it's in existence, the net effect is it's positive. And that is basically what Bitcoin is.
Find my entire interview with Chairman Greenspan on townhallreview.com. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
The city argued they were trying to be inclusive, believe it or not, by firing the chief because they didn't agree with his views.
The First Amendment on trial. When the final segment of the Town Hall Review returns in a moment, stay with us. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In 2010, the city of Atlanta fired Fire Chief Kelvin Cochran for authoring a book about his Christian beliefs on his own time. The Alliance Defending Freedom came to Cochran's side after it had become clear that his First Amendment rights had been violated. Here's my Salem colleague, Michael Medved, with the chief and ADF senior counsel, David Cortman.
Tell us what's happening with this law case that you've taken up on behalf of the chief.
Yeah, so the city argued they were trying to be inclusive, believe it or not, by firing the chief because they didn't agree with his views. So I didn't quite understand that. But we filed a lawsuit on behalf of the chief. The good news is that we argued that the policy, they actually required prior permission. So they told the chief afterward that, oh, no, you can't write a book on your own time for a Bible study unless you get prior permission from the city, and the city allows you to do so. We challenged that as being unconstitutional. His only prior permission needed is the First Amendment, and the judge ruled with us. So the judge ruled in favor of the chief, and now we're going ahead to trial to figure out where the case goes for there and how much damage is for the chief.
Oh, that's terrific. So this is all still pending. But again, I just want to remind people that right now, for the rest of this week, if you give $100 to Alliance Defending Freedom to help fight for Chief Cochran and for clients just like him, who are defending their own religious liberty and defending your religious liberty, if you give $100, it's going to be doubled because there's a matching fund going on right now. Please give what you can. $500 would be great. That's a terrific goal because that provides $1,000 to this vital cause. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the banner for Alliance Defending Freedom, or if you want, you can call. It's toll-free. It's 866-954-3388. Their operator's standing by. That's 866-954-3388. Chief Cochran, if you win this case with God's help, Do you hope to go back to your work in public service?
Yes, I'm actually seeking to be restored everything that I was taken away from me, including being restored to the office of Fire Chief of the City of Atlanta.
Well, I can only wish you Godspeed with that. I am deeply motivated to support the work of this great organization. You should be, too. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the banner for Alliance Defending Freedom. It's a great opportunity this week. If you move today or tomorrow, go to Alliance Defending Freedom, and your contribution, whatever it is, whether it's $10 or $10,000, will be doubled this week.
A quick and exciting update. After 3 years in the courts, the city of Atlanta awarded Chief Cochran $1.2 million this week, recognizing their treatment of him was unconstitutional. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Generalissimo Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.